Chariot Solutions TechCast Episode 40, a discussion with members of the Open Solutions Alliance on open source and the enterprise. Welcome to the show. I'm Ken Rimple. We've been working with some of the companies in the Open Solutions Alliance for a while and are a solutions and integration partner. I was able to get representation from some of the member companies to chat about open source software this August. This talk is geared toward business leaders and is less technical. However, we discuss open source software in various enterprise settings and how product companies like Progress, Jaspersoft, and Ingres have adopted open source as the core of their commercial product offerings. Just a note, this is our 40th episode, and I'd like to thank everybody for listening and continuing to support the show. Now let's take you to the OSA discussion. What I'd like to do just before we get started, we're going to talk a lot about open source, its adoptions, issues in the enterprise and how it can help and a whole bunch of different things. But I'd like to just start out by kind of having everyone introduce themselves. So can we start with Nick Halsey?
Sure. And Ken, it's great to be here on the call. I run marketing and product management here at Jaspersoft and have done for about the last 3 years and have been involved in open source for about 6 years now.
Debbie Moynihan.
Hi, I am responsible for community management and marketing for the Fuse open source integration and messaging software at Progress Software. And I've been involved in open source for quite a few years. A lot of our underlying development for our products is done at the Apache Software Foundation.
Deb Woods.
Hi, it's great to be here, Ken. Yes, I'm responsible for the product management here at Ingres. I've been working with open source for about 10 years because prior to Ingres, I was at Red Hat. So excited to be here and looking forward to the call.
Anthony Gold.
Hi, Ken, and hello, everyone from the OSA on the call today. And my name is Anthony Gold. I'm the president of the Open Solutions Alliance. I'm also a board member of BlueNog, which is one of the OSA member companies. And I am also now recently the CEO of a company called Healthy Humans that builds healthcare solutions for people with chronic illness, all built on top of open source software. And prior to all of that, I created and ran the open source business for Unisys Corporation. And while I guess I've only been in the open source world for about 9 years now, it feels like forever.
All right. Well, again, thanks to everybody for attending. Chariot has been, I guess we're an integration partner with the OSA. We've been talking a lot about open source with our clients. In fact, most of our work involves or is directly open source based. So, you know, what I'd like to do is just kind of open up with kind of the state of open source in the enterprise today and ask, and obviously we see it from an integrator's perspective, but in terms of open source with, you know, open source commercial products, or I should say open source products and open source adoption, like where are we today versus, 4 or 5 years ago?
This is Anthony. I think what's really interesting that we see, and you see a lot of people and analysts reporting this way, that it's obvious to most people in the open source world that open source is becoming more and more popular, particularly as it gets traction in the enterprise. And of course, it started at the edge and it's working its way toward, you know, much more mission critical types of things in the environment. But an interesting thing, if you look at, you know, Gartner's most recent analysis, they say something like that 85% or some very, very high number of all their respondents are using open source, and nearly half of those are using them in mission critical applications. We see that more and more, which of course is why so many of us are involved with open source companies, whether building solutions or leveraging open source to realize those benefits. But the interesting thing is how quickly the consumption of open source has started to grow and become more mainstream, particularly in the mission-critical environment, which, of course, is very good to those of us on the inside. I think part of it is the what's going on with the economy and the interest that people have, or the renewed interest in looking at that. But I think a big part of it is the quality of many of the software components that are out there and much of the open-source ecosystem that has enabled that to happen.
This is Nick. I'd be happy to jump in. at Jaspersoft, we've been very interested in trying to find real market data about how people are deploying open source business intelligence and whether that's accelerating. So we partnered with Infobright to sponsor a research study that was published today, coincidentally, by Mark Madsen. You could all come to our website and download the full report. But one of the highlights of the data from the survey was that over 40% of the over 200 companies that responded indicated they have deployed or are planning to deploy this year open source business intelligence solutions. Now, that's just one sector of the market, but it's showing a very high market penetration rate, primarily here in North America, where most of the respondents came from.
And we'll put the link to that in the show notes. One of the things that has been happening over the last, year or so, with the economy is some consolidation, some purchasing of companies that traditionally had led open source initiatives like Sun, things like SpringSource being bought out by VMware. How does everyone think about, is that a good thing for open source? Do you see it as a risk?
Well, this is Deb. I would like to say that I think there is certainly some potential for risk that's there. And it's really going to sort of prove out to see how these solutions play. Certainly, there's a tremendous amount of mindshare around these open source solutions that have been purchased. And as those communities continue to foster and grow, we're hoping that those companies that have purchased them will continue to support their communities, which is what I would expect to happen, because I think when they purchased them, they were certainly looking for the value that the open source was bringing. And in today's economy, everyone's looking for ways to put more open source in there because of the significant cost savings it brings to bear. So it's helping some of the proprietary solutions offer more cost-effective solutions as well.
In regard to open source and government, for example, even the government is being pushed towards looking at open source. It's Deb Woods, right? Deb, you worked on the open government initiative, right? The open letter to Obama?
Absolutely. And I think if you look what's happening out in the industry right now, there's a tremendous amount of interest in our government, certainly with Obama's interest in providing more transparent government and his reach out to a number of the people in the community as well to get involved. By working on the letter, we were able to unite a number of companies and sort of making an appeal to the U.S. government to take a look at open source solutions. I know there's a trade show coming on, the Gov 2.0 coming up in a few weeks. It was recently a consortium down at Georgia Tech last 2 weeks ago for government interest around open source. So it literally seems about every 30 days we're seeing a group of people getting together and trying to learn more about what's happening in open source and how the government can take advantage of it. So I think we're going to see much more use of open source in the government in the coming months and coming years as more interest and more solutions are ready and can carry the business critical and mission critical features that they're looking for.
Now, had Obama and the administration, have they started to adopt open source measures at all in open source software?
There's a number of solutions. There's a recent group called Open Source for America that was launched, about 2 weeks ago now. And if you look on that website, it's opensourceforamerica.org. There's a number of case studies. There's examples of the DOD. There's the Coast Guard that's taken advantage of it. There's several examples there of where we're seeing, I think even NASA's got some deployment there, various members of the military and government agencies are taking advantage and deploying, and in some cases actually contributing and being part of a growing open source solutions in their environments as well.
And if I could add to that, Ken.
Sure, Anthony.
Obama has said that he is prepared to go through the budget line by line to really look at where spending can be cut. And of course, there are obviously huge opportunities there. And I think it was Errol Lewis of the New York Daily News who said that President Obama is our first open source president. I haven't heard Obama speak directly on open source, but as Deb mentioned, or as you mentioned, we did put together an open letter that we sent to Obama on open source and getting that, leveraging open source and the benefits that it brings to areas of the government. And certainly we're starting to see some traction there, particularly in segments like healthcare and other verticals where we know that open source can have a significant impact.
How do you address questions that I'm sure critics will throw out there about, you know, healthcare and such, where, you know, they're concerned about security and privacy? Like, is there something, you know, I guess the potential criticism there is, oh, if it's open source, anyone can contribute. Therefore, there's a potential security hole, or someone could put code in there that's not, you know, would not be authorized in a private organization and private code base. What's your take on that?
It's the age old question of, you know, is it more secure or less secure because it's open? You know, there definitely is that the idea that, you know, with enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. Fairly certain, although I can't recall the names of the studies that were done, there were a number of studies that were done to show the security scores or measures, if you will, of proprietary software and various open source softwares, to show that open source software is as secure as proprietary software. Now, this is, of course, not across the board, just like all proprietary software elements are not secure. But when you look at the mission critical types of things, you know, I think there's a lot of people and a lot of organizations who have put time and effort and money behind ensuring that the open source software that's there, the stuff that runs in mission critical environments, is indeed secure. Now, that doesn't mean that you're, because it's open, so let's take, you know, an EMR system or something that, you know, may be built on top of open source software because it makes it, you know, much cheaper to build, much faster to add new features and functions and those sorts of things. That doesn't mean that patient data is exposed or that really proprietary secure things aren't encrypted and secured in databases that can't be accessed. So I think there's sometimes red herrings that are thrown out there that, well, open source, the code is open, therefore, you know, it's you know, not secure in any way. And, you know, that's really, I think, kind of misleading when you really look behind what the architecture looks like and how things are built.
Right. There's a lot of painting with a broad brush.
Oh, yeah.
On. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to add to that. This is Debbie. Just to say that I think the security question really comes down to each specific project or product and how much focus there is from that team on making it a secure application. And people don't just pick open source. I mean, the open source projects go through the same rigorous evaluation. We worked with FAA, and they looked at our open source software, and they compared it very heavily, rigorously, through a lot of testing with other commercially licensed software, and they did decide to choose our open source software to standardize on, which was, of course, really exciting for us. But I just want to point out that, you know, you have to evaluate each piece of software, and people don't just say, oh, I'm going to go with it because it's open source. They actually do compare it, and in many cases find that, you know, it actually does better than the other choices for them.
So, Deb Woods, with Ingres, you moved from having more of a proprietary software model, right, into open source. Is that correct?
That is correct.
When did you guys do that? How long ago?
They did that roughly, I want to say, about four and a half years ago. It was actually done when it was part of Computer Associates. And then the Ingres was spun out, and a private equity firm acquired it. And basically, some of the reasons it was done at the time is, in talking with a number of the customers, you know, they wanted to become more involved with Ingres. They wanted to contribute to the code. They wanted to help influence the roadmap. And by opening it up, we were actually able to expand the actual QA of the product, because in an open source environment, you have a much more diverse set of groups that are testing in areas that you can't really replicate in a QA lab yourself. So we were able to get a much more robust test suite, so we feel that, you know, the product is a much higher quality, as well as now with our community, we have code sprints all across the globe that contribute and help influence where the product roadmap is going to go. So we know when we bring out a new feature, it's truly value add. We have customers that are willing to commit, that are working with us, testing with it, and there's a lot more traction around what we're doing. So we know everything we're delivering to the marketplace has value, it meets a customer need, and around the security point, absolutely. We have a lot more people testing the code, contributing to it. So if there is, you know, a breach or there's some issue that's found, there's a lot of people certainly there and involved that sees it and can help us fix it much more quickly than it could when it was a closed product.
And it's interesting because, you know, bringing the community into a product, I know we work a lot with SpringSource, for example, and, you know, when they put out a new release of something, there's heavy forum support, there's questions, people are submitting Jira bugs from the outside community, and they're really becoming part of the process and part of the whole development team in a way. And it was just like what you said, Anthony, about kind of like all bugs are shallow with enough light on them. So I would agree with that myself.
If I could chime in on that, I think it's essential to the whole business model of open source companies. Now, at Jaspersoft, when we go through a release cycle, we've got about 5,000 of our community members enrolled in the beta and QA process, which is a huge time and cost savings contribution for us. Similarly, we deployed a mechanism on our Forge to make community translations easier to do, and our community translated over 50 different language versions of our products, which would have been a significant investment as well. So there are very directly measurable cost reductions as well as accelerators to delivery of new software that the community delivers.
If I could just add on top of that for a moment, you know, interestingly, one of the things that we saw at Unisys was that while open source software is definitely becoming more and more widespread as we sort of open this conversation talking about, what we found was that most of the companies that we dealt with did not have any formal procurement or governance policies in place for really bringing open source software in, and were really kind of scratching their heads thinking about what's the best way for us to do this. Do we treat it the same way that we treat all traditional software? Do we need to have extra policies in place and, you know, to look at things like the community and so on and so forth? And that's something that we got from a Unisys perspective heavily involved with.
You know, two other things that I definitely want to bring up. One of them is around open source licensing models. And I know that, you know, when we get involved in an open source review, one of the first things people are concerned about is, you know, what am I signing up for when I use this library or that library? So, in working in your different products, what do you find to be licensing models that make a lot of sense for your customers, and what do you find ones that become more of a hang-up?
Well, I think this is Debbie Moynihan, that the Apache and BSD licenses are the easiest. That style of license are the easiest for people to bring into their organizations. There's not a lot of restrictions on how people can use them, how they can modify them, and things like that. But I've certainly seen people use all different types of licenses. I think the legal organizations within companies are coming to better understanding of open source. And actually, if you look under the covers in many commercially licensed products, they have some of these same licenses under the covers. So, you know, whether end users are using commercially licensed or open source license, in many cases they have, like the LGPL, for example, license embedded within products. So, you know, I think it really just depends on how you're using it and, you know, how you're going to be deploying it in your environment.
At Ingress, we take advantage of, we use the GPLv2 for our community version, but we also have a commercial license because a number of our customers actually embed the Ingress database, and those are proprietary solutions, and they need a choice where they can elect not to have the GPL inside itself. That they love the idea of they're using open source a solution where they can contribute and test and be part of the community. But when they deliver their end solution, they want to make sure they're not affected by the viral nature of the GPL. So we have customers that sort of, you know, portray and play in both spaces. And that's why we use the dual license model, and we find it very beneficial to our customers and our partners to offer the choice.
That kind of leads me into my next question, which is, so, you know, you go to a lot of these tools and software and APIs and products, and you can certainly download the community, quote unquote, edition. And in many cases, a lot of people develop with and even sometimes put that into production and don't necessarily pay any fees to the company. And obviously, a lot of these companies are in business to, you know, they're providing services or providing, you know, licensed versions with support and things like that. Is it generally practical, are you finding it easier or more difficult to make money being an open source product company?
We at Ingress have not run into that because most people that are deploying a database in an enterprise, they would never think about putting a production system like that without support. So we have very few customers that run without a supported offering. I think it really depends on the project you're looking at and how critical it is and what kind of business critical workloads it's carrying. But that hasn't been an issue for us in Ingress.
Yeah, at Progress, our software, the open source community editions are developed within the Apache Software Foundation. So either, you know, they would come to a vendor like us that has a lot of the committers on staff and we can provide the support. But there are some cases where, you know, other companies have individuals who are also committers on the project and can support the code. So I would agree that, you know, we are seeing that pretty much everyone needs someone who knows the code to be able to support it, because just using it, even though you have access to the source code and you can see it, you don't want to be in a situation where you're running a mission critical application and, you know, it's the weekend and you're relying on someone to help you on a mailing list. You want to have a guaranteed response time. You want to know that there's going to be someone there to help you fix that problem immediately. So, you know, we're definitely seeing the demand for the support offerings, even though it's open source.
Sure, sure. And also with a higher order product, it's not just an API that you can code around. You know, you're dealing, for example, with Jaspersoft, you're dealing with ports. You know, you're not necessarily going to have a person on staff that's going to be able to go into Java and fix the code necessarily.
Yeah, and we also, it's interesting because we've had situations where we use a lot of open source internally and we have these same discussions ourselves of, do we need a support contract for this? Should we try to support it ourselves? You know, we also work with Chariot Solutions in some cases to help us out as well. But we've had situations where it wasn't until we had a critical issue and then we got support. So I think early on, a lot of people take that model of, hey, I can use community support, and then, you know, this obviously wasn't a mission critical application for us. Otherwise, we would have had a support agreement. But so when it's not mission critical, some people will take a wait and see approach. But, you know, you do run into the situation where you need it fixed immediately or as soon as possible, and you're trying to just get a contract in place for support. So it's not an ideal. I would recommend people look earlier on to get the support contracts in place.
This is Nick speaking. I actually think this is one of the most confusing areas for companies that are looking to adopt open source solutions because of the variety of business models that are in the market and different offerings. You know, some companies are supporting a community open source license product that it's a support only contract. Others have an open core model like Jaspersoft, where there are commercial extensions to a core open source platform. Some people offer support, some people offer services, some people offer configurations, depending on the type of open source license that the core project might use. And we found that educating the customers about what is the difference between a community and a professional subscription, and what are the different levels of warranty or indemnification or support levels, is the longest part of the sales cycle. And I think one of the benefits of the OSA are the efforts we are making to try and make the complexity of the various business models easier to understand and more transparent to corporations as they get smarter about how to deploy open source.
Well, that was kind of a nice softball into saying, what's the OSA? So does the OSA actually provide support and things like that? What are your goals?
We don't necessarily provide support directly per se, although most of the member companies all do. The whole point behind the Open Solutions Alliance is to help drive open source and open solutions into the enterprise. So specifically, we look to drive standards. We look to drive community. It's apparent that the market is moving more and more to a hybrid type of environment where there's open source software, there's proprietary software, there's a little of everything in there. And we see the Open Solutions Alliance really as the business thought leaders of open source in the enterprise. And it's a way that we can help, as I mentioned before, drive those standards, drive the community, build reference architectures, and bring a lot of the hottest open source companies and open solutions providers together in a way to help cultivate that, promote that, and to help espouse the virtues of that for companies around the world. You know, interoperability is obviously a key thing, and people struggle with how do they, you know, get all their enterprise components to play together particularly as open source plays a larger and larger role. And so what we do is to help pull all those various pieces together and to drive those open source and open solutions into the enterprise.
Do you have people coming directly to the OSA? Are they referred through your companies? I mean, how does that generally work?
It's some of both. We have organizations that come to the Open Solutions Alliance requesting to be a member, and we have various categories of membership that we offer. We have our various member companies whose affiliates would like to be part and join because they've heard of them that way. And we actually have people who find us just from the various activities, the events that we do, the things that we put on Twitter, the various blogs that we write on behalf of OSA or each of our member companies. We even have one of the categories of membership that we have in the Open Solutions Alliance are end users of open source software, consumers of open source software. And we have the largest independent financial institution in the UK, Redmayne Bentley, is one of the members of that organization, part of the OSA. So we have open source developers, we have open source services companies, and we have end user customers who are all part of the organization. And we feel that it's very important to have that 360 view. We've all come together because we all have the same beliefs and passions around how open source can help and open solutions can help in the enterprise. Our mission is to help drive that and make that easier and help ease that path that we're all on.
So coming up, you have Open World. Can someone talk about the Open World conference?
Yeah, one of the big annual events in Europe is the Open World conference in Paris. That's October 1st and 2nd. Many, many industry speakers are going to talk about the state of the market, and I'm going to be representing the OSA in particular on a panel with Jim Zemlin from the Linux Foundation, Mike Milinkovich from Eclipse Foundation, and Cedric, I'm going to apologize, I don't remember Cedric's last name, from OW2, where we're going to be talking about how organizations like the OSA and other industry standards groups are helping move forward industry adoption of open source.
How do you interoperate with some of these other groups? Like you mentioned, the Eclipse Foundation and things like that. What's your involvement with these other open source alliances and communities?
I can comment on that from Progress Software's perspective. We're members of the Eclipse Software Foundation. We sponsor the Apache Software Foundation. We also participate in several standards organizations. And we each group that we participate in as a company, we do it for different reasons. You know, obviously, the Eclipse Foundation and the Apache Software Foundation, we fund developers that work in those organizations. But the reason why we were interested in OSA was really to actually help us understand the broader open source ecosystem, because there's, you know, as we mentioned earlier in the call, there's a lot of different business models out there, and we wanted to understand, you know, what's working for everyone else, how can we look at license compatibility, interoperability, and these were some of the things that were really attractive to us at OSA. So I would say, you know, various members are participate in the different organizations out there depending on their business models. And for me and for our company, being part of OSA has helped us better understand and, you know, learn how to, you know, work within everyone else's business models, because there are a lot of models out there.
Here at Ingress, I would echo those same thoughts. By participating in OSA, we've been able to learn more about interoperability between solutions. We've actually taken a number of bundles and appliances to the marketplace where we've partnered with members of the OSA in delivering those solutions. And it's been a key sort of underpinning of ours. I know Ingress and Jaspersoft have worked together to deliver some solutions, and it's been quite effective. And I think the OSA has helped bring more companies together to share that knowledge. And yeah, I think as we go forward, we'll see more and more of those opportunities out in the marketplace.
I would add one other thing to that, Ken, which is that the OSA is not intending to try and be the only organization that exists for open solutions providers. I think that most of the members all do belong to the various community organizations. The reason we formed the OSA a couple years ago and that we've been growing and thriving, and we've been growing pretty well, is because of what I said about our shared mission to try and drive open source and open solutions in the enterprise. So because we're not trying to define new standards, much more trying to create reference architectures and drive best practices and those sorts of things. You know, it's a great fit for, I think, what a lot of people are looking for, both from companies that are developing open source and open solutions, as well as companies and users that are consuming it.
Right. Hence Open Solutions Alliance, not Open Source Alliance.
Exactly.
I'd like to thank everybody, Nick Halsey, Debbie Moynihan, Deb Woods, Anthony Gold. Thanks for coming on the Chariot TechCast to talk about the Open Solutions Alliance.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks to the members of the Open Solutions Alliance for taking the time to talk to me on the show. Our show notes are available for you on our podcast site, techcast.chariotsolutions.com. Chariot is now delivering official core spring training, and I'll be teaching our first class on September 29th. Details about this and our upcoming one-day Grail seminar can be found at our website, www.chariotsolutions.com. Leave us feedback. Email us at techcastfeedback@chariotsolutions.com or Twitter with the hashtag TechCast. Our podcast themes are Free Theme Number 3 and Free Theme Number 4 from podcastthemes.com. For the TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.